For decades, telecom giant AT&T provided the National Security Agency with billions of emails and telephone calls. And it helped wiretap all internet communications at United Nations headquarters in New York. The relationship between AT&T and NSA has been described as unique and especially productive. And according to the New York Times, AT&T had an extreme willingness to help NSA long before the 9/11 terrorist attacks. In this hour of midday, Sean Gallagher, Baltimore-based IT editor for Ars Technica, talks about AT&T and mass surveillance and what's ahead for bulk data collection. Also, using a drone to smuggle drugs, tobacco, and pornography into a Maryland prison. And how about Europe to Australia in 90 minutes? Midday on Tech with Sean Gallagher after the news. And welcome back to Midday, everyone. Our second hour, Dan Roderick's here with Midday on Tech with Sean Gallagher, Baltimore-based IT editor of Ars Technica, the wonderful website. Nice to see you again, Sean.
Good to be here, Dan.
Oh, guys are constantly busy. There's never an end of tech news, IT news, news from the internet, news about privacy and surveillance and metadata and all of that. It's endless.
Yeah, there's never a slow news week.
No. No, we got a couple of things to talk about. One is a local story, like here in Maryland, the use of a drone possibly to bring in smuggle in contraband into a Maryland prison out in Western Maryland. We get to talk about that with Sean this hour.
Right. So they were trying to smuggle marijuana and rolling papers and things like that in.
Yeah,
and this is a growing phenomenon. We've seen this happen.
You want to start with this story?
Sure, sure. Why not? Why not?
Let's jump right in. I like
that. So, you know, one of the things that happens with all technologies is that the first people who figure out how to do something really innovative with it are criminals. So
that's kind of true.
So with this, in this case, you know, the drones, since the cheap drones, these quadricopters that have computer control to allow them to fly more in a more stable fashion. I mean.
And they have a little cargo space, right?
Well, some of them have cargo spaces. Some of them, you just strap stuff onto them. So let me back up for a second. So there's quadricopters and these other radio-controlled flying aircraft. They're essentially model aircraft. They require a great deal of human control. I got one a while back. I still haven't figured out how to fly it. I've crashed
you haven't,
a bunch.
You?
No, but this is not one of those sophisticated ones.
I understand.
So when we talk about drones, we're talking about not these model radio-controlled things that you fly with two sticks. We're talking about remote-controlled but computer-driven aircraft ranging from the size of a toaster to the types of the Reaper and things like that that the Air Force and the CIA and the Army fly over Afghanistan and other places.
Right.
They have onboard computer-assisted flight, so the computer can fly the plane where you want it to go, or the quadricopter or whatever, where you want it to go, without you having to stick it the whole way. So they're stabilized, they don't fly off into some other place where they're not supposed to, and they fly unattended, right? So you can lay in a course for one to fly, and it'll go off and fly off on its merry way, and then come home when you tell it to come home.
It's all pretty cool.
All pretty cool. So, and they've gotten cheaper and cheaper. A company, DJI, out of China, makes this one called the Phantom, which is particularly popular. It comes ready to fly, and it can. This is the one that the guy accidentally flew onto the White House lawn.
Mm-hmm.
They also have a database in them that's supposed to keep you from flying them in places you're not supposed to fly them, in no-fly zones. But that's easily overcome. As somebody discussed at the security conference I was just at in Las Vegas. So what happens is you get these things, and somebody just buys one of these things off the shelf at a hobby shop, or they order it online, and they're able to, you know, without any kind of training, put it up in the air, fly it someplace, take pictures with a camera if they want to, or in this case, strap on a shoebox full of stuff with duct tape and fly it into a prison.
Some drugs, pornographic DVDs.
Exactly.
This is all alleged.
Well, these are all things. Well, this is all alleged. But, you know, the thing is that everything is cash in prison, right? You know, anything that you can get from the outside that's contraband is equal to cash in prison. 2 years ago, somebody did this in Georgia, flying in cartons of cigarettes.
And cartons, plural.
Just cartons of cigarettes. Yeah, they had put a little box in the bottom of a drone and flew it over the wall.
Must have been a pretty good sized drone.
It was a decent sized quadricopter. It was a homemade one. Somebody went to a lot of work to build one, and they got caught. The drone was caught on the ground, and the people who were operating it out of a car in the woods nearby were caught by the prison guards.
I'm sorry, it just seems kind of funny to me. Did you go park in the woods somewhere near the prison and think you can fly over a drone?
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously, there's got to be a certain number of people who are getting away with this.
Do you think it's happening?
I think it's happening. I think that, you know, because there have been people caught doing this, I have a suspicion that there are a lot more people who haven't been caught doing it.
Probably a good suspicion. Probably realistic.
And also in other countries as well. I mean, there was a case in Thailand last year where someone was flying cell phones into a prison with a drone. And the drone got caught up in a tree, and that was the only reason they found it.
The drone doesn't have to land inside the wall?
No, it just fly over, and in some cases, it just releases, opens a case underneath it, and things can be dropped.
So you have to time the drop,
right? So there was, in fact, in Detroit earlier this year, somebody flew a drone over a park in Detroit and dropped money on the park, you know, dollar bills, about $100 in dollar bills out of a hatch on a drone. I guess just to see what would happen.
And what happened?
Well, people were scrambling all over this park for money.
I can't imagine. So did they get a video out of it?
Oh, there's a video. There's a video online.
What would be the point of doing that if you didn't get a video out of it?
In fact, if you check on Ars Technica, there's a link to the video from a couple months ago.
ArsTechnica.com.
Yeah.
In this case, in Maryland, we have two men arrested, a 25-year-old gentleman from Frederick County, another from Silver Spring. Each faces multiple drug and gun-related charges in connection with this incident. And they apparently were trying to smuggle in, you mentioned rolling papers, synthetic marijuana.
Right, spice or whatever they call it.
Yeah. And I want to ask you about this. The Secretary of Corrections, Stephen Moyer, who met with reporters at Patuxent Institution. This occurred near Cumberland.
Right.
At our Western Maryland facility, prison. He said that drone detecting technology would cost between $350,000 and $400,000 per institution. Wouldn't it be cheaper just to have a guy up in a lookout tower? Here comes another drone, fellas. Get me the shotgun.
Well, shotguns are a very effective way of taking a drone.
I would say.
There was a guy who shot down a drone over his backyard not too long ago in Kentucky. Which has turned into a whole legal issue.
I can imagine. The drone operator owner probably thought this was destruction of property.
Well, he was also arrested for discharging a firearm in a reckless manner.
Okay.
He has a defense fund on Kickstarter.
I can imagine. So he's saying that's an invasion of his space,
right? He felt this guy was flying over his house perving his daughter.
Oh, really?
So we don't know. He said here in this case, but
what about
case,
detecting devices? 350. Why do they always say we're going to have to spend $400,000?
That's an oddly specific number, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, so detection of drones counts on picking up their radio signals back to their controller, which would require that you have radio listening equipment installed, and I guess that's the number they're using. You can just as easily put up chicken wire. I mean, because honestly, one of the things they've talked about is a defense against drones flying into places is basically putting a giant net up, and catching things, because that's one approach. And another approach is, you know, depending upon how big the drones are, you have a laser that shoots them out of the sky. I mean, they've done demonstrations of this. They're not very expensive, but they're available. But the thing is, detecting it in the first place, you have to find the signal for it, and that doesn't always work, because some of these may have been pre-programmed to fly. They don't have any remote control, so you're listening for a radio signal from something that's not broadcasting.
What about the old eyeball? My idea: if you're going to spend $400,000. That's the salary of a correctional officer with a shotgun for, you know.
Well, the thing is that these things are, you know.
8 years? 7 or 8 years?
So we're talking about something the size of a pizza box, essentially.
Yeah.
Right? So, or maybe smaller, depending upon what they're flying.
Hmm.
So it's got a relatively small visual cross section. If it's dark, it's going to be difficult to spot it.
Yeah, okay.
Especially if they've disabled the lights on them, because a lot of these drones specifically have lights on them so that people won't hit them. Right.
Right,
or they will, so they can see them.
Well,
while
we have big
flying.
Spotlights at prisons, don't we? Couldn't you wash the sky looking
for
drones?
You could have infrared detection. You could have a number of other things, but you know, it requires somebody to be watching.
I find this amusing. I like your theory that this is probably going on already.
Oh, I'm sure it's already going on already other places. I mean, these guys are not geniuses. They're not the first people who have tried this. We've had a number of articles about this being attempted in other places.
Have you seen other examples of, you mentioned how the first people who are really innovative with technology are diabolical, right? They're thinking of some.
Well, yeah. I mean, you think about all of the ways that things could go wrong with things.
Right.
I mean, one of the
or
problems.
Be used,
if you think about technology in general, I mean, you could take it as far back as say 9/11. We had a failure of imagination around thinking that somebody would fly an airplane into a building,
didn't
occur to us that hijackers would do that. Well, it's the same with every other technology. If somebody finds a way to exploit a piece of technology, they eventually will. So, for example, today I wrote a story about how there's a remote control app that most of the phone companies and cell phone manufacturers put onto Android phones. That's there for customer service. But it was done in such a way so that somebody could exploit that and use it to gain remote control of your phone. So they could get on your phone, get access to all of your data and all of that. And it's so deeply embedded in all these phones from LG, Samsung, HTC, that it can't be removed without reprogramming the entire operating system.
Wow.
So
I say, oh, brother, I mean big brother.
Several million phones
are
exposed to this, and it's already being exploited by people for some, you know, for trivial reasons. For example, there's an app that's on the Google Play Store that uses it so you can record your screen, and they're downloading this vulnerability,
right?
In order to do that,
that's very odd.
So there's all sorts of questions about who might be using it for other reasons. You know, we see this happen all the time in technology, and that's why there's people in the security research field who pretend to be bad guys to try and find ways to make bad things happen with devices that the original developers hadn't thought about, and that includes automobiles, which I can talk with a little bit.
We are going to talk about that a little bit today, about hackers, who already have us concerned about our PIN numbers and our bank accounts. Now you got to beware of the car hacker.
Right.
The car. So, we'll talk about that. Also, I want to ask this question as we take our first break here on Midday on Tech with Sean Gallagher. A question for our listeners that has to do with this story that we're going to talk about next. AT&T being a partner with the National Security Agency for decades.
Yes.
Providing all kinds of information to the NSA, emails, phone calls, even helping the NSA wiretap the United Nations. Billions and billions of emails and phone records, right? So my question for our listeners, because we've talked about this before when Sean's been here, is are you offended by this? Where are you in all this invasion of privacy business? Do you feel that it is? I don't know where you come down on this. The latest revelation is something that long suspected, that AT&T, the giant telecom giant, was involved for many years providing information to the NSA, probably about your emails or phone calls, especially if you called somebody overseas. Does that offend you? 410-662-8780, or is this just life in the 21st century? Our email address, midday@wypr.org. Dan Roderick's here with Sean Gallagher from Ars Technica. Midday on Tech. We'll be right back. And back with Sean Gallagher, the Baltimore-based IT editor at Ars Technica. So when the story broke in the New York Times on the front page of the Sunday paper a couple weeks ago about AT&T's long relationship with the National Security Agency, providing the NSA access to billions of emails, records of cell phone and landline phone calls, and I mentioned the wiretap at the UN, The New York Times and ProPublica got their hands on a document, I guess, from the Snowden leak
right.
a couple of years ago that led to this. And I wondered, like, is this a story? Is this what's the big deal here? Isn't this something we already knew?
Well, let's think back to when all of this began. AT&T was a much different company in the 80s when this started.
This actually, one of the projects goes back to 1985.
Right. So back in 1985, during the Reagan administration, let's think back. It's all the way back in the Reagan administration.
This is before the internet.
And we were in the Cold War.
Yeah.
And AT&T was a company that dominated the telecommunications industry at the time. It owned all the long distance in the country, if memory serves me correctly, except for, say, Quest and people like that.
And then there was a big court case.
So back in 1985, AT&T was where you had to go to get to this sort of thing. And they were the telecommunications presence in every city, and they were our only connection overseas at the time, really, other than some of the leased services like cable and wireless and folks like that who had cable, who had international calling.
Mm-hmm. Right?
And so, naturally, the intelligence agencies wanted to cultivate a relationship with AT&T at the time. And AT&T, the A in AT&T stands for American, right? They felt it was their patriotic duty to cooperate with the intelligence community at the time to provide this sort of intelligence capability. And so they started this partnership with building databases and giving them the capability to do wiretaps and things like that. Now, I have to say that ever since the Communications Assistance to Law Enforcement Act, CALEA, was passed, all of the telecommunications companies in the United States have been obliged to assist law enforcement, but they also charge law enforcement and the government agencies back for that assistance. They have organizations within phone companies that essentially operate as a sales force to deal with CALEA requests. Hmm. So they charge the law enforcement agencies money back for wiretaps and things like that.
Oh, okay. So,
it's a source of revenue.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not a huge source of revenue, but some of these deals that have been done with NSA, FBI, and things like that over the past two decades were fairly sizable pieces of money. So it wasn't entirely out of patriotic dedication that phone companies did these things. However, right after 9/11 in 2001, people at the phone companies were coming to the government and saying, how can we help? And how can we help catch the terrorists? And people in the intelligence community and law enforcement were going to the phone companies and asking them for them to help. And that is back when we were talking about things like total information awareness and this whole idea of building a capability of understanding everything that was going on the phone networks in the United States, on the internet, and being able to track everything. And that ran into a number of issues, most of them constitutional. But as the idea of this total information awareness faded, there was still this relationship between all these companies and
NSA.
The NSA.
Mm-hmm.
So, and back in 2007, a retired AT&T employee filed a suit with the EFF's, the Electronic Frontier Foundation's assistance, to get information released on what the NSA was doing in a secret room at a facility in San Francisco.
He wanted to know what was going on in there?
Yeah, well, he was trying to, he was a whistleblower. He was saying, you know, because he said, you know, the NSA was essentially monitoring all of the internet traffic passing through this one building in San Francisco.
In 2000, he said,
this was
2007.
This was in the mid 2000s.
Okay.
He filed the suit in 2007. He had retired. He wanted to get information on what they were doing in that room. And the AFF wanted to get information on what was going on in that room. And the case sort of stalled out because the court said, well, it's secret. You can't expose that. But there was documentation of this equipment that the NSA had brought in, which was allowing them to essentially split the off from the fiber optics that were coming into this facility, the fiber optic cables coming in with all of the information from the internet connections that AT&T managed, off into other boxes so that NSA could collect it all. And we know now that that was part of what evolved into what we call X-Key Score, which is the system that the NSA uses to monitor outbound and inbound international internet traffic.
I'm sorry. We're talking about the internet
and
emails.
And then we also know that the NSA had been collecting phone records, business records, basically the phone calls themselves, the metadata for phone calls since the mid-2000s.
Right. We know this from Snowden's revelations.
Right.
Okay. So back to my question for my listeners here. Does that, what Sean was just describing, does that bother you, offend you? Do you think the NSA was looking at your email as a result of that? What do you see the value of this?
So there's,
what are the two sides of this
question?
There
are a couple of arguments around this. Yeah. On one polar extreme, there is spying equals bad, right? So we don't like having ourselves spied upon by our government. We have a right to privacy. And that's a fair, and that's a position that is defensible.
Fourth Amendment,
right. On the other side of things, there's the argument that the NSA is just doing its job to try and keep track of people outside of the U.S. or people inside the U.S. who are working with foreign powers to do damage to us,
right?
And that's their job, and so of course they should be doing this. You know, in between lies a lot of ground. So, you know, for example, AT&T cooperating with the NSA for them to spy on the UN. Well, we have an intelligence need to understand what people are talking about the UN. There's diplomatic espionage has been going on since there have been two countries in the world. You know, it's been going on for forever.
And we're not the only one.
And we're not the only ones
doing that.
I think it's fair to say that, you know, all these things around OPM and all that show that other countries are hacking us just as bad as we're hacking them.
China remains the lead suspect in the hacking of the Office of Personnel Management.
They remain a suspect, but they will never be publicly called out for it. And that's because there are too many other things on the table right now.
I think the Obama administration has said as much, right?
Right. And then Russia has
its own. But Donald Trump, it doesn't stop Donald Trump.
Oh, it doesn't stop Donald Trump. No.
Nothing does.
So there's the argument that, you know, really, AT&T is cooperating with the NSA in a way that assists the U.S. in defending its interests, that is theoretically, at least, the least invasive to American citizens.
I said to you before, I don't know of any poll survey that I've read where people are highly offended by this. I think there's a great deal of ambivalence about it in the United States.
There is. And I think, you know, there are a lot of people who early on, and I've got to say, you know, I come from a school where I believe in the protection of privacy. And I also interact with people overseas quite a bit because I'm a reporter and I talk to people in other countries. And I don't think that it's great that, you know, my government is necessarily monitoring my communications with these people. That said, at this point, the revelations that are coming out now are sort of piling on to what we already knew, and they're providing more detail into some things. And they're really getting into tradecraft in many ways. That the stuff that I really don't want to know, to be honest. I mean, I think that we understand that the NSA has been collecting phone records, and the thing is that now that that hasn't changed really with the legislation that was passed, with the changes that are being made for how the NSA does searches of metadata. All that's changed is that the data is now at the phone companies and not at the NSA. That's what will happen when this.
Okay, do you mind going over that again? Because this is supposed to happen in November, right?
Right, right.
So please explain to us so we can understand what the difference is.
All right, so up until this bill was passed, the NSA had warrants out with all of these FISA warrants, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act warrants out with each of the telecommunications providers telling them, we need access to your phone records for your phone calls. You're just going to dump us the raw, and we're going to store it, and we're not necessarily going to look at it with human eyes. We're just going to put it in this database, and our computers are going to churn through it all and look for relationships between specific indicators for individuals who you're interested in and other people. And all of that data is going to sit in our database in an NSA data center, and we're going to look at it all, and we're going to keep it for this amount of time and then dump it.
Now, that's what Congressman Dutch Ruppersberger referred to as the haystack.
Right, the haystack,
The NSA would have the haystack.
Right, and it's looking for needles in the haystack.
Right.
So in theory, it would only look at phone records that were related to investigations of specific individuals. Now, right. from the Snowden stuff that came out, it's apparent that some people went, like, celebrity hunting and things like that, or checking up on their girlfriends.
Mm-hmm.
So there was some abuse of that. There was even some wiretaps ordered.
Did I miss the one about checking up on girlfriends? I missed that.
No, so there was...
some NSA people
doing that? Yeah, there was an NSA employee who is no longer an NSA employee, I might add.
I missed this one.
Who was checking on, who tasked surveillance on a girlfriend.
Just to get her phone records or
to
emails?
See if she was talking to somebody he didn't want her talking to.
Okay.
Right. So that was something that
he's working at Chili's now.
That was something that the NSA acknowledged, and in a report about the limited number of abuses they were going to talk about, they mentioned that, and they said the guy was disciplined and he's no longer an NSA employee. There were about 6 or 7 of those cases where people misused that were announced. But still, NSA had the haystack, and you know, you can go dive in the haystack if you had the right permissions.
So what's the change in November?
The change in November is that instead of NSA having all the data, the phone companies will have to save all the data and then give it to the NSA when they ask for it.
Okay.
When they get a warrant.
Okay.
From the same court that gave them the warrants to get the data in the first place.
Okay. Does that make you more comfortable?
No, the thing here is that the phone companies...
How about you, personally?
The phone companies hang on to the data longer than the NSA would have.
Yeah?
So some of the phone companies hang on to call data for as long as 7 years.
Hmm.
The NSA was only holding on to it for 3 to 5 years. So the NSA will actually, in fact, have access to a longer period of
phone
calls.
Why did we make this distinction? Because of the outrage over the Snowden revelations that
it was
captured
because
the government had it.
Well,
because
yes,
the government had it. So now we trust AT&T.
We trust, yes, exactly.
Who is a full-fledged, robust partner with the
precisely,
NSA. Right?
Precisely. So this doesn't really change the game at all. It just changes who's holding the data. And it limits the NSA's ability to go on a hunt for something automatically. I can't order up a search of all the records across all the phone companies.
They have to get a warrant for something specific.
They have to say, I'm looking for this. But the thing is that the way that they can ask for the data, if they're following the same methods they've used before in terms of determining who they're going to search, they're looking for connections within 3 hops from a particular search indicator.
So let's say a suspected terrorist in Yemen, Cleveland taking phone calls from this person in Yemen.
Right, and then you've called the same guy in Cleveland. It's the same. Like, let's say the guy in Yemen orders something from Amazon.
I'm sorry.
Or he orders something from a pizza, or he orders something from Amazon, and he calls Amazon customer support because he didn't get what he wanted. And then you call the same number. You're 2 hops away from this terrorist in Yemen.
And so I would be included in that warrant? Theoretically,
without being named, yes.
Okay.
I mean, then we just say we want everybody who's within 3 hops of this guy.
All right. And how much, practically speaking, does that slow down the whole process of investigating a possible terrorist?
Given what they have to have had in terms of infrastructure to plug into the phone companies to get their full dump of data already, I don't think it's going to take that much, because I think all it's going to require is a phone call. And they already have connections deep into the phone systems of
mm-hmm.
these phone companies,
right.
because that's how they were getting the phone records, right? So essentially,
don't they need a judge to say?
They
it's
need
a FISA judge.
Right?
To
oh yeah,
say?
Sure. But they're not going to get any more broad, long-term warrants, right? But they could just get warrants renewed every month, and we're not going to know about them because they're FISA warrants and they're top secret, and we don't get access to them.
Right.
So you're going to have situations where I'm the NSA. I need to look for this guy. I'm looking for anybody who's connected to this person who's operating out of Yemen, who's got connections in the U.S. And I go to the phone company and say, I go to FISA, say, I need this warrant. Or I go to AT&T and I say to my friend AT&T, who I have such a close, robust relationship with, hey, you mind looking this up?
Right.
Okay. Because once you get into a non-warrant situation, when the company itself is collaborating with NSA, there's no need to go through the warrant process. I mean, because those are business records, and according to the way things have been judged by federal justice officials. Any phone transaction is a business record. It's not your data. It belongs to the phone company. So the phone company can do whatever it wants with that data.
Right.
Right. So if AT&T wants to share everything still.
Practically speaking, it doesn't sound like there's that big a difference.
No, not really.
Wow. So, I mean, the President Obama, when he talked about reform,
It reforms is that the NSA no longer has the full feed of all phone calls.
Right.
Instead, it has to ask for pieces of them, and that process requires another hurdle to jump over.
Mm-hmm.
And then it also requires that they have the ability to essentially search those records remotely on the phone company's data records.
Sean Gallagher is our guest here on Midday on Tech in this hour. If you have any comments or questions about what you've heard so far in the show, please give us a ring, 410-662-8780. I'm still wondering, if maybe people are just tired of this. There's some fatigue about these revelations about the NSA.
I think that there is. I think at this point, people have reached the point where they've reached peak Snowden, where they feel like we've really reached the point where there's nothing else that will surprise us at this point out of the NSA records. And most of what we're getting now are things that are deeper down into the files that are just confirming things that we've already said. And so the response, they're important to know in many cases. And a lot of these, because basically we can say these things happen, but then when we have proof, that's an entirely different story, because we can then say, yes, this document shows that this happened. Because honestly, as somebody who's covered defense technology since the mid-2000s, I knew there was equipment that could do the things that we say the NSA has done now, that companies were working on for quite some time, that was being marketed to the intelligence community. It's been there. And I knew the capabilities were out there. We just didn't know how they had been implemented. And now we have the specifics of how it was implemented and which companies were involved. And that's, for history's sake, that's important.
Okay. But for individuals, how would we even know whether our Fourth Amendment rights are being violated or not?
You could put in a FOIA request, I suppose.
To see whether they did a search for you?
And then you can wait a year or two for that to go through.
This is a comment by email. This is kind of amusing. This is from Wax, who says, I feel if you end the war on drugs, many people would be more comfortable with electronic monitoring by the intelligence agencies.
That's probably true. Now, ironically, and I think we discussed this before,
but the
NSA feeds a lot of data to DEA.
DEA, yeah.
In fact, they had the entire...
I'm amusing. I'm not,
they were, the NSA was monitoring the entire phone system of the Bahamas.
Why do you think they were doing that?
As part of a DEA thing.
Yeah, okay.
So that's...
I just think it's funny.
Yeah.
Here's a question for you back on drones. It brings us back to that question about air rights.
Mm-hmm.
Whose space is being... George in Towson wants to know, do drones trespass? Do homeowners have air rights? And if so, how high?
Ask the FAA.
How high?
Because the FAA still has to come up with the regulations on this. I mean, if you were to take the FAA regulations as they're written today, if you were to shoot at a drone and the FAA were to consider a drone an aircraft, then you would be breaking federal law. Because you're hindering the flight of an aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not you have air rights is a huge question, and it's one that still needs to be resolved. And I think it will never be completely resolved until the FAA issues
final rules
on
what
an aircraft is. I mean, the thing about drones is that you can buy them off the shelf someplace. Especially with consumer drones, right? Consumer drones are one thing, and then there's government and corporate drones. They're a totally different story. I mean, drones are very useful for things like agriculture, for surveillance. It's for the military, obviously.
Real estate.
Mm-hmm. And we're looking at other commercial applications of them that are going to be very important, and I think that drone technology in the long term is going to be good for people. On the downside, we have all these consumer drones that have capabilities that normal human beings... It's like giving normal human beings superpowers, right? A lot of people are going to go try them out.
Yeah.
Right? So, there's the concern that you've got privacy invasion because somebody's flying a drone looking in your back window.
Or you might cause damage.
And there are a number of states and local governments that have passed laws restricting drone use. Some of them which are going to run smack into federal law. And a lot of this still has to be hashed out in the courts and hashed out in
administratively by the FAA.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. We'll take a break here and come back. 410-662-8780. A short break. We'll be back with Sean Gallagher from Ars Technica if you have any questions about matters tech. And when we get back, the prospect of flying from Europe to Australia in about 90 minutes. 410-662-8780 if you have any comments or questions. So the Federal Aviation Administration bans commercial drone flights except for a few dozen companies that have been granted waivers by the feds. The ban will remain in effect until the regulations that Sean was talking about, Sean Gallagher, become final. That's about 2 or 3 years from now, according to this story that I'm reading. FAA officials plan to continue granting waivers case by case. About 300 waiver requests are pending, and new requests are being filed almost daily. And then the rules that they proposed, I guess it was in January or February, would ban the aircraft from flying at night or close to an airport. So you couldn't do a drop at a prison, see?
Right.
Because it's banned at night.
Right.
You couldn't possibly do that.
No, you couldn't do that.
They also limit flying over people not involved with the flight. What does that mean?
Well, okay.
You can't just sort of fly over somebody's wedding.
So there was a case recently.
Right?
There was a case that precipitated a lot of the
rules,
the conflict
rules.
Over the rules.
Yeah.
So there was an administrative judge who basically said the FAA doesn't have a leg to stand on right now because these rules apply to a specific class of things called model aircraft. And if the FAA is trying to place the same rules that they have for aircraft, for all aircraft, onto drones, they have to apply it to paper airplanes as well. And because there was this gentleman who was flying a drone to film a commercial for a University of Virginia hospital. And there was a complaint against him for recklessly flying the aircraft because somebody had to dive out of the way of his first-person view
okay.
aircraft as it flew under an overpass.
Okay.
And he was doing it for commercial purposes. He was selling the video to the University of Virginia's hospital.
Right.
And so the FAA charged him and fined him like $100,000, things like that. And then it was thrown out by this administrative judge. And that's still being processed. What that ruling meant was still being processed. A lot of people jumped up and said, okay, that means I can fly stuff now. But the FAA has been sending nasty grams, has been sending cease and desist letters to people who are commercially operating drones without having one of these waivers.
Hmm.
So the FAA is still actively trying to enforce the same rules. And those rules say you can't fly it out of line of sight, so you can't.
You have to keep it in eye shot.
Right. So that means means you can't fly, Amazon can't fly delivery drones yet because they wouldn't be able to watch where they
went. So under the new rules, Amazon, which had this developing this delivery system called Prime Air,
they would have to change those rules when they implement them.
Oh.
And Amazon would have to get a waiver. I mean, there's a number of things that have to happen for all that to happen. So Amazon's building this capability to fly delivery drones. Yeah. Baltimore, I don't know if Baltimore City is going to be a site for a test, but we're in that 1 hour, 2 hour delivery zone for Prime. And the idea that you could then start, I mean, right now you got guys driving around in cars dropping stuff off on your front porch.
Right.
Right. Well, it's not inconceivable that Baltimore County and other areas around Baltimore City and some parts of Baltimore City where there aren't, say, overhanging trees and power lines that would take out a drone could be served by this drone service when they launch it, which means you'll have these medium-sized helicopter drones flying around, dropping into your front yard with a box and dropping it off.
I didn't think about the tree and power lines problem.
Well, yeah, think about Baltimore City. There's so much overhanging stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, we
got to bury the power lines. I've been saying this all along because El Nino and all those super storms we have,
right.
They take down the power. They should be buried anyway.
They should
Here's another good reason And Jeff Bezos can fund it.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. And then Google can run fiber to everybody and we'll all be happy.
Sean Gallagher from Ars Technica. So 90 minutes, Europe to Australia. I bring this up because you had a story recently about a German company that could make such a thing possible.
Well, it's actually the Germany's Aerospace Research Center is trying to push this plan forward. And we're not talking about this being available until the 2030s.
Okay, well,
so it's a ways off still. But the idea is, and this is something that's been, an idea that's been floated for quite some time. So this whole idea of hypersonic air travel, in which you essentially have a space plane. It's an aircraft that you shoot up into space, into suborbital space, that skims along the top of the atmosphere at ballistic speeds, and then it re-enters into the atmosphere and lands at its destination in 90 minutes or less, your money back.
Wow.
So they were originally looking at it could do across the Atlantic in less than an hour. It could do from Europe to Australia in 90 minutes.
And does the Space Center in Germany, do they believe there's a market for this?
They do. They do. And it's not just for sending people that distance. I mean, now they're looking at a 100-passenger vehicle to do this. A mid-sized, smaller airliner capacity. And it's going to be a fairly exclusive audience for that kind of business. If you
I
can
would
imagine.
Say.
You know, if I've got to be in Australia in 90 minutes, right? So...
I mean, the idea of it just so it seems incomprehensible.
But even if it's a small percentage of travelers,
yeah,
they're figuring that would generate enough revenue and enough interest for them to really start to ramp up development of these reusable rocket systems that put these things into orbit or
into
suborbit.
Yeah, I saw a reference to that reusable rocket system.
Yeah, so you've got to boost the thing into orbit. Now the thing is, or into suborbit, and the thing about these systems is that so this isn't like going to the airport and, like, checking in and walking up the jetway and sitting down, finding your seat and putting your baggage in the overhead. These things are going to launch vertically, like the space shuttle.
Like a rocket.
Yeah, like a rocket. So this is not exactly going to be the height of comfort, all right? And this is not and Southwest is not going to be getting into this market, as far as I know. But the idea is that if you're going to be spending money on these and there's interest in these, you generate enough of a pipeline to build these systems to launch these aircraft into space that you can then use it as the basis for other cheaper reusable rockets to put things into orbit. So, for example, instead of putting an airplane on the back of one of these things, you put another rocket that's going to take something up into orbit and you shoot it up and then you launch the rocket from the reusable device. And so you gain, you know, it's cheaper to launch things, cheaper to put more stuff into space, and cheaper to get vehicles up into, say, the range of the International Space Station or other places where we could set
I
up.
See.
So the idea is that we can get more stuff, heavier stuff, into space cheaper. It's sort of what they originally intended the space shuttle for, but in this case, the only thing that's reusable is the rocket. Is the rocket booster
what
itself?
What kind of stuff are you talking about putting into space, Sean? Satellites?
Satellites, generally.
That's the obvious one.
Satellites, generally, but also, so there's been a lot of discussion about space tourism. There's been, we're generally speaking about things that are going to be put in orbit, space stuff put in, which means a satellite. So this means that, you can get new GPS satellites up faster. You can get things like the Iridium cell phone satellites up faster.
With the advances in 3D printing, why would you need to go Europe to Australia in 90 minutes?
Well,
couldn't you teleport yourself? Couldn't you recreate yourself in Australia?
They haven't figured that part out yet.
If you need this is a hammer that you really need, and you don't want to wait 90 minutes, couldn't you just, do it by 3D printing?
It would be cheaper.
Yeah.
But I would say that, there are... There are always going to be a class of people who feel they need to be someplace that fast. That's why the Concorde survived as long as it did, even though it was highly inefficient and costly. There's a market. If there's a market for it, I mean, Donald Trump would, if he's not elected president, would probably be one of the prime customers for this sort of thing.
Right.
I mean, people who have a lot of money, to whom time equals money, and are willing to spend money to save time, would probably buy into this. So
here's a question for you on our earlier subject today, the NSA and the collection of all this data. Can Sean talk about data profiles? This is from Stephanie. I'm assuming that the NSA has to create a profile for every single person in order to determine which people are bad actors. What I'm wondering is, does the government have a profile for every person in the U.S., maybe for every phone account?
Well, it's illegal for the NSA to keep profiles on American citizens.
Huh.
Unless they're people who are being investigated as agents of foreign nationals or something like that. So, no, I don't – but they don't think they need to keep a profile on people. I mean, the thing is that – so they keep what they call identifiers on individuals of interest that are they're investigating.
Okay.
But remember that they have this giant pool of data about – you know, so, you know, up until we shut off this phone metadata thing, and which we're going to be turning back on in a different way – the NSA had the ability to essentially search through all of the connections between people by phone. And they don't need to know who you are. They don't need to know anything about you to do that.
They just need a phone number.
If anybody's keeping domestic intelligence records, it's the FBI. And that's an entirely different game. And it's so, you know, if you want to find out if somebody's keeping a record on you, the best thing to do is send a Freedom of Information Act request to the FBI and say, I want to know what's in my file. If there's been any intelligence collected on you that's been aggregated and viewed by human beings, the FBI is going to have it, most likely. The NSA is, by its charter, restricted to foreign intelligence. So anything that they have on individuals in the United States are only in relationship to connections to people overseas that they have as persons of interest, and I don't think they're necessarily profiling us.
Hey, where is Snowden these days? I've lost track of Edward Snowden.
He's still in Russia, as far as I know. He's been.
Yeah, that's the last I heard.
Yeah, he is. He has been trying to gain, basically. There's been talk about him trying to move to Europe to get immunity and diplomatic immunity in Europe and possibly Germany. There's been several attempts to get something like that through the German government based on some of the information I've had, but I don't think that's gone anywhere yet because the diplomatic pressure is very high on Germany.
We didn't get to automobile hacking.
No.
We didn't get to drone hacking either.
No, we didn't. So
we're just about done today.
They're basically come from the same angle.
Yeah.
So I can say in brief.
Yeah.
So there's a feature story I just wrote on ours about auto hacking. We talked briefly about this, with Sheila Cass about the Jeep hacking stuff. There were several research projects that were revealed over the last couple weeks when I was in Las Vegas for Black Hat and DEF CON and there was also one revealed in D.C. the week before last, of these hacks of technology and vehicles. So basically, you have a system where if you've got anything that connects cellularly to a part of your car, whether it's your OnStar, in this case, the stuff that was hacked was Chrysler's Uconnect system, and there was a Tesla that was hacked, but not over the internet. And then there was these things called an OBD port dongle used by insurance companies to track how well you drive.
Oh.
They were all hacked, and the people who hacked them were able to gain control over parts of the vehicle. So they're able to turn off the brakes, turn on the brakes.
You found something similar going on with a certain drone system,
too. Well, it
was
a Parrot drone that you were able to...
Parrot drone?
Yeah, Parrot drone. You're able to telnet, able to log into the drone and turn it off.
And turn it off?
Yeah.
So it crashes?
Yes.
maybe the state of Maryland, the correction system, ought to invest in that.
They should probably invest in that, yes.
Sean Gallagher, Baltimore-based IT editor for Ars Technica, joins us from time to time to talk about tech here on Midday. Thank you, Sean.
Thank you, Dan.
Have a great afternoon, everybody. See you again soon.
Midday's producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producers are Michael Himowitz, Melody Simmons, and Connor Graham. Our interns are Samantha Max, Beatrix Lockwood, and Max Bookdahl. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming is available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.